Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, June 8, 2016. South Sudanese react to a New York Times piece written by President Kiir and Riek Machar.
My opinion on the op-ed that was authored yesterday by the president and the first vice president, New York Times, calling for truth and not right, is to me not a surprise, because a person of right mind could not negotiate himself or herself into jail or stand trial for that matter. I say this because the principal parties to the peace agreement, majorly the government of the Republic of South Sudan and the SPLM-A in opposition, are the primary accused of the violation of human rights and international humanitarian law.
And our reporters went to the streets of Juba to ask what South Sudanese think of the opinion piece written by the two leaders.
It is like the leaders should be accountable, because we know how they started and who masterminded, you know, the crisis in this country. So for me, as at the grassroots, I can tell you that those in Juba or those in the government actually started.
We'll have these stories and more coming up shortly. We start the show by hearing from South Sudanese about what they think of the idea by the two principals that the hybrid court, as is stipulated in the August peace agreement and signed by both President Kiir and First Vice President Salva Kiir, should be removed. Here is what some people had to say on the streets of Juba.
For this country to go back into its normal, there must be accountability. And especially those who have been involved in all those atrocities must be held accountable and be brought before the justice and let them answer, you know, for the atrocities that they have committed. So each individual who has committed crime has, you know, the responsibility of standing before the court of law and justified.
The major people who are supposed to be held accountable, the commanders who were in the front line, they are really responsible, because they are the one who influence the local communities to go and attack their fellow members.
To me, the way I see, my opinion is the person or the group or an organization which is to be held accountable in this atrocity would be after maybe the results of the truth and the truth commission which is formed, and they have areas to work in. So I think out of that we can get who should be held responsible, and the person who should be held responsible should be exposed to the people to know that who was behind the atrocity for the last 2 years.
I don't think there are specific people who are supposed to be held responsible or accountable for what happened. Basically, I think some of the international people knows of who and who was involved into this kind of conflict. So they can be put into trials, so they can either be proved guilty or innocent. No one is guilty till proven innocent.
The concerned personnel who should be taken to the court, these are the two commander-in-chief. They should be taken and they should specify exactly those commanders in the booth who were responsible for this. Because when we go back to the reality when the war broke out.
The report was very clear that both parties committed crimes and both parties committed the war crimes. So for those who are to be held accountable, I normally say that both parties to the war, all those who participated in the war, and all those who committed the crimes, all the war crimes, both of them have to be brought to books, and both of them have to be tried equally.
So to me, actually, it is like the leaders should be accountable, because we know how they started and who masterminded, you know, the crisis in this country. So for me, as at the grassroots, I can tell you that those in Juba or those in the government actually started. Some are in Iowa, they have come back to this country, misinformed the public, what is going on. material we kill each other in the country.
I think the perpetrators should account. And I want to say that South Sudan actually needs truth-telling process. We need to try the people, and they should be convicted so that there is an element of accountability. There is need for investigation.
These are voices of residents of Juba reacting to the opinion piece written by President Salva Kiir and first Vice President Riek Machar in the New York Times yesterday, advocating for a truth commission on the atrocities committed during the two-year conflict in South Sudan that would grant amnesty to people who participate and tell their accounts of what occurred rather than holding them accountable in a hybrid court. Civil society activists are also criticizing the opinion article written by President Salva Kiir and first Vice President Riek Machar, published in the New York Times. President Kiir and Machar are calling for a truth and reconciliation commission instead. Activists say the two leaders are trying to eliminate the formation of a hybrid court as stipulated in the August peace agreement. For VOA News, Waki, Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
My opinion on the offer that was authored yesterday by the president and the first vice president in the New York Times calling for truth and not trial is to me not a surprise, because a person of right mind could not negotiate himself or herself into jail or stand trial for that matter. I say this because the principal parties to the peace agreement, majorly the government, Republic of South Sudan and the SPLM-A in opposition, are the primary accused of the violation of human rights and international humanitarian law.
That is Benny Gideon Mabor of the South Sudan Law Society reacting to Mr. Kiir and Machar's joint opinion article entitled South Sudan Needs Truth, Not Trials. The two leaders opened their piece by saying, quote, building a nation is not an easy task. We know this because it is our life's work, end quote. The three-page article stresses the need to implement a national healing, truth, peace, and reconciliation program as opposed to forming a hybrid court to try people accused of committing atrocities during the conflict. But lawyers and activists say the two leaders' plan condones impunity and would not improve the culture of distrust in South Sudan. David Deng, research director at the South Sudan Law Society, says Mr. Kiir and Machar's proposal would mean dismantling the peace deal.
You know, I think the South Sudanese people have seen this game played out over and again, time and again, with amnesties being offered to people who wield violence, and them being welcomed back into the fold with political and military appointments, and how this generates a cycle of violence where people are able to benefit off of wielding violence. And the only way to really stop that is to begin raising the cost of violence. And the hybrid court for South Sudan would be one important means of doing that.
Deng says there has never been any legal process that has held people who have gravely committed human rights abuses in the country accountable.
I fear that if they're able to defeat the hybrid court, then the rest of the peace agreement will also go. There's nothing to stop them from dismantling the peace agreement bit by bit. I think it's an important time when those who want to see this peace agreement implemented can stand up and hold the parties to their commitments.
Eddie Monyakani is the executive director of the Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, or CEPO, a South Sudanese civil society activist organization. He agrees with Deng. Yakani says while peace, healing, and reconciliation should take place first before justice, rolling back justice and efforts to hold the people accountable for the atrocities committed means a failure of instilling trust and confidence in the government.
You are sending a signal that people will start using violence as a way of buying political leadership. Any politician that is discontented with the system will use violence as a way of buying political power. And the question now we have is that how do we stop that? How do we create a system where people not use violence as a way of buying political power?
Yakani points to the period between the time when Sudan's general elections were held in 2010 and 2013 when the conflict broke out. He says leaders who were discontented during the 2010 elections took up arms against the government. He says since they were pardoned in 2013, many believed that heading to the bush is the only way to achieve power. Mabor agrees. He says Mr. Kiir and Machar cannot undo a hybrid court.
Their option is to call for reconciliation, as they have rightly put it. But nevertheless, the two leaders have signed agreement, which constitutionally obliged them to subscribe to this international or regional legal instrument, the hybrid court, which is going to be established soon by the African Union Commission and subsequently ratified by the transitional government.
The executive director of Voice for Change, a human rights lobby group in Juba, calls the OPIT painful.
Of course, this is why sometimes, you know, there is that continuous recurrence of this conflict taking place in the country, because they know they won't be held accountable. You know, we were hoping that this peace agreement has to be implemented the way it is.
Mabor has one piece of advice for the two leaders.
If they could locally conduct opinion polls on that opinion, and the opinion poll is to ask the question of what do they prefer between truth and reconciliation and legal accountability. And the answers could be published by the same New York Times. If the answer is in their favor, then of course we can welcome the idea.
Chapter 5 of the peace agreement calls for establishment of an independent hybrid court from the national judiciary, which shall be supervised by the African Union Commission. The court shall investigate and prosecute those individuals bearing responsibility for violations of international and South Sudanese laws since the beginning of the conflict in December 2013. For VOA News, I am Waka Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, teachers at refugee camps say they need more teaching materials and trained staff. That story is coming up.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you concerned about global warming?
Not much. As much as we talk about it, I don't see much. This thing, global warming, I don't see its impact, personally. That's my personal opinion, so I'm not concerned about it.
Yeah, I'm concerned, because when we stay in hot places, we could not be settled at all. So what we can do is to advise people not to deforestate the land. At least we should advise them to reforestate. Yeah.
Yes, I am, because I know that it will, in the end, spoil our environment and also affect our health. Yeah, our health will be damaged because of all this that we keep doing to the environment.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. We now take you to the Nuba Mountains, where SPLM North representatives are in the United States. They say they have come to Washington to remind the international community and the U.S. congressional lawmakers about the war in Sudan's southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states. Fighting in Sudan's southern Kordofan and Blue Nile areas have inflicted suffering on the entire population of the two states. Rebel officials accuse the government of using Russian-made cargo planes to drop barrel bombs on civilian facilities, forcing hundreds of families to run and take cover in nearby mountains. The U.S. representative of the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Movement North says the world is turning a blind eye to the suffering of the people in the Nuba Mountains. Philip Tutu says international aid agencies must rescue families who need urgent relief assistance in southern Kordofan.
Our people is still trapped in caves for 5 years without food, without water, without medicine. They need to take action to give humanitarian access to these people in caves.
Tutu says the international community and the U.S. lawmakers should urge the Obama administration to pressure the Sudan government to end attacks in Nuba Mountains, Blue Nile, and Darfur areas of Sudan.
and to save the kids that their children are there, give them basic life needs in these areas. People are blocked from humanitarian aid, so they are really in need of humanitarian. Situation is bad, and especially lately, because the government has started, like every year, they have a dry season offensive, actually in Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile as well as Darfur. All this, we are here to remind the world about the war in Sudan, general three areas.
Tutu says the SPLM North has been negotiating with the Sudan government to allow humanitarian aid agencies to access people in the war zone where civilians are trapped. He says the Sudan government is blocking all efforts by international aid agencies to deliver urgently needed aid to the people of Nuba Mountains.
SPLM is ready all the time to sit down, and we sat down, well, this is more than, this is 13 times we sit down. Whenever we refuse to sit down for peace talk, we always ready. When we give an invitation, we never refuse to sit down, but we are ready more than government.
In March, the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel brokered a framework agreement between the Sudanese government and various rebel groups to stop the war in Blue Nile, Southern Kordofan, and Darfur. But the rebel group Justice and Equality Movement, SPLM North, and the Sudan Liberation Movement, Minni Minawi faction, have all so far refused to sign the agreement. VOA fellow Nadia Taha prepared this report in Washington. Today, in our continuing series on the UN African Union hybrid mission in Darfur, or UNAMID, we examine the ongoing talks about the peacekeeping mission's next exit. While Sudanese government says UNAMID should leave Darfur because the region is now peaceful and stable, observers dispute that claim and say the people of Darfur still need peacekeeping mission. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Juba.
Despite rampant insecurity in Darfur, massive displacements of the civilian population, human rights abuses, and continued outbreaks of violence, the government of Sudan has been insisting for months now that the UN African Union hybrid mission leave the region. Ashraf Issa is the UNAMID spokesman in North Darfur State.
The conversation about exit strategy was actually mentioned. The first mention of exit strategy was mentioned in Resolution 2173, where the Security Council asked the Secretary General to put in place plans for an exit strategy for UNAMID. And of course, this is a routine thing that happens. The mission had already been in its seventh or eighth year of existence, and this is the time at which the United Nations and the African Union look at the longevity of the mission, so to speak.
Late last year, a committee was formed composed of members of the United Nations, the African Union, and the government of Sudan to formulate an exit strategy as mandated by the Security Council Resolution 2173, which extended the African Union-United Nations hybrid operation in Darfur for 10 months until 30 June 2015. The resolution also requested further realignment of the mission's activities in accordance with recent strategic reviews. Ashraf Issa says the Security Council is reviewing the mandate of the mission.
There has been discussions about the benchmarks for the mission to start drawing down its operations and so on. This conversation is going to continue this year, and once the tripartite committee puts across its recommendations to the Security Council and to the African Union Peace and Security Council, then these two entities, along with the sovereign state of the government of Sudan, will make a decision, and then we'll have a clearer picture.
Sudan government argues that the region is now stable with no active war between the government and any of the three major Darfur-based rebel groups. Government officials also claim that the 2011 Doha document for peace in Darfur, signed by the government and a coalition of rebel groups, has brought peace to the region. Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal said the Darfur administrative referendum held 2 months ago has ushered in a new period of stability, peace, and development in the region. University of Khartoum lecturer Ismail Ibrahim says the situation in Darfur is unpredictable.
If you can just see what happened just after the referendum that has been conducted, you know, recently, under the umbrella and under the slogan that peace has prevailed in Darfur back to their original places, and just you can see and how it triggers, you know, the conflict between two tribes, and it spilled over even to involve the government.
Ibrahim is referring to the violent clashes between militiamen belonging to the Ma'aliya and Rizegat tribes, which is swept across Darfur. Rizegat militiamen attacked the home of East Darfur State Governor Anas An-Nur in Al-Ba'an, killing his security guards. Governor An-Nur was not home at the time of the attack. The wave of violence took place right after the Darfur referendum vote, before the results were announced. Ibrahim says Darfur needs UNAMID, but he says UNAMID must do more to protect the civilians in Darfur.
So I don't think that Darfur without UNAMID could be more peaceful, and at the same time also, as long as UNAMID is acting the way it has been acting since it has been deployed so far, also I don't think that it will be is going to have a real contribution to peace, to making peace in Darfur.
Political analyst Haj Hamad says donors are not satisfied with the work of UNAMID.
The money is spent on blue hats that are not doing their business or quite inefficient to apply its own mandate. I think everyone who is paying for them will benefit to give an exit strategy.
Hamad says UNAMID's failure in carrying out its mandate has given the government of Sudan an excuse to say the country does not need UNAMID in Darfur.
Their own mismanagement of the situation have led that they are no longer having the trust of the communities or the government or the rebel groups.
Tomorrow we will look at political measures that observers say should be in place before UNAMID leaves Sudan, and what should be done to improve UNAMID's performance until that time comes. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
An Eritrean man believed responsible for running a major migrant trafficking network will go on trial in Italy. Mered Medhani was detained by Sudan and extradited to Rome yesterday. He is accused in a 2013 boat tragedy near the island of Lampedusa that killed hundreds of migrants. Prosecutors say his arrest is a turning point in the fight against people smuggling. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story. From Rome, she spoke to VOA's Joe Di Capua.
This is seen as an incredible breakthrough for law enforcement officials in Africa and in Europe. Mered Medhani is a 35-year-old known as the General because of his operations. He modeled himself on the late Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, and he's alleged to be responsible for sending thousands of migrants through Libya across the Mediterranean to Europe. An arrest warrant was issued for him in 2015 because he was believed to be responsible for the tragedy that occurred off the coast of Lampedusa in October 2013, where at least 350 people died. So law enforcement officials in Italy, in the UK through the National Crime Agency, and Sudanese police have been working together to arrest Mered. So this is quite a breakthrough to see someone of this caliber actually extradited to Italy to stand trial.
Now, when was he detained in Sudan?
We understand he was arrested towards the end of May, around May 24, and was just brought to Rome late last night. It's amazing, really, when you think about the cooperation that's gone on here. And there are telephone taps claiming that Mered boasted about how many people he was cramming onto these really shoddy boats and deliberately putting too many people on the boat so that he could make as much money as possible. And he also talked about where he wanted to invest all the profits he was making, saying it was better to invest in America or Canada because there was less vigilance, less surveillance about the money. He's alleged to have charged migrants around €5,000 a head to make the journey to Europe, and is also accused of paying off officials in Libya in order to conduct his business. He also had a very elaborate network throughout Europe, not only in Italy, but it seems that he had a network of contacts in the Netherlands and in Scandinavia. The police say that his wife lives in Sweden, so it's not clear whether he was eventually hoping to get there.
Now, the wiretapped conversations apparently say that he was responsible for smuggling up to 8,000 people a year to Europe. Any idea how long this operation was going on?
According to Italian police documents, he's been conducting these operations since 2012. He also had such an elaborate network in Italy, he was able to notify his colleagues on the ground precisely when the boats were leaving and their expected arrival location and time, particularly well organized to move these people through Italy to other parts of Europe overland once they hit the coast of Italy.
Now, I see a top Sudanese police official is quoted by the wire services as saying he is accused of smuggling youngsters from Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan across the Mediterranean through Sudan or Libya or Egypt.
I haven't seen anything in the Italian documents talking about children, but there's no doubt that there would have been women and children involved in these journeys, particularly as we've seen that in the recent months, just how many women and children have perished as they cross the Mediterranean from that Libyan coast to Italy.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She spoke to VOA's Joe Di Capua. Elsewhere in Italy, the ANSA news agency reports a police officer shot and killed a migrant who stabbed him at a camp in the southern town of San Frandinado. Reports say the officer was wounded when he and his partner tried to break up a fight between two migrants. The camp is usually home to thousands of seasonal workers who pick oranges. That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song You Are One in a Million by Justin Simpleman. We have been listening to Justin Simpleman with the song You're One in a Million. Remember, those are not my words. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.